Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, everybody. As you've been hearing all morning, if you've been following the news, Mitt Romney is back from his excellent overseas adventure, having proven that international diplomacy is not his greatest strength. So we will probably see a running mate news conference very soon to change the topic, I would think. And meanwhile, it's back to the central message of his campaign. He's got business experience and Barack Obama doesn't. So he won't want to read the new article out today by Vanity Fair national editor Todd Purdom. Hi, Todd. Welcome back to WNYC. Todd, can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Oh.
Fine. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you. Thanks.
Sorry.
Sorry about that. You compared the success of those presidents who were successful business people before becoming president and those who weren't. In office. You were surprised to find the big three business successes of the last century to go on to the presidency were Warren Harding, Herbert Hoover, and Jimmy Carter?
Yes, I mean, it's funny that that happens to be the triumvirate, but it's the case, and you couldn't really argue that any of the three of them had successful presidencies. Of course, Harding died in the middle of his, which was clouded by scandal that wasn't really known until after his death. Hoover, the Great Depression happened on his watch, and he seemed powerless to know what to do about it. And Jimmy Carter has become the modern shorthand for failed one-term president, although he's had a very distinguished post-presidency. So their success in the private sector didn't translate to political success.
And among those who were not in business or who were business failures before becoming president, you mentioned George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and FDR. Is that even fair to go back to George Washington, who, by the way, did own a plantation, right?
Yes, and he was a very good businessman. It's just that he spent so much time fighting the revolution and then inventing the presidency that by the middle of the second term, his finances at Mount Vernon were kind of in shambles. And when somebody wanted to take a loan, he wrote a kind of intemperate letter saying people's estimation of my wealth is vastly overstated and I've got a lot of problems of my own. Among other things, by the way, he had a distillery, so he was actually a good businessman. It's just that he was distracted from his business by the pursuit of
So that doesn't quite fit the mold here. But Lincoln, what did he do before getting into politics?
Well, he'd done many things, but one of the things he did, he was a storekeeper in New Salem, Illinois, a little village near Springfield where he failed so badly that he was paying off what he called the national debt. Harry Truman famously had a haberdashery business in Kansas City that went bust, and he was paying off debts for more than 15 years, so much so that he was in financial straits during much of his time in the United States Senate before becoming vice president.
So if somebody wanted to run against him using today's sensibilities, they could say, would you hire a failed haberdasher to be president of the United States?
Not only could they probably would, Brian. I mean, you can just hear the ad now.
Right. And yet I guess he did okay in the Oval Office. What about the people who came from money, like Kennedy and FDR? There was business in their blood, I imagine, if not on their resumes per se.
Well, yes, and of course, President Kennedy famously said when he tangled with some steel barons, my father always told me businessmen were sons of bitches, but I never believed it until now. Huh. So certainly people like FDR and Kennedy and, for that matter, both of the Bushes had a lot of exposure to wealthy people, successful business people. They knew what the ethos of the business world was like. And, of course, Bush 41 had in fact, been a successful oil man in Texas before really leaving to pursue a public service career. So
he should really be, in fairness, he should really be on your list.
In a way, he should be as a person who had, who had been successful in the private sector. And, of course, his presidency looks better in hindsight, in part because of the two terms of the second President Bush. But let's not forget that at the time, he was defeated for re-election and his presidency was seen as kind of a disappointment.
Right, like Hoover and Carter, another one-term president. One of your theories for why business people struggle as presidents is this very colorful line from your article that I'll read. Most business people have never dealt with the wily, needy, fickle types who populate a typical legislature. Is that how you write about the Congress of the United States?
Well, Well, I think one of the things that, you know, business people say is about, quote-unquote, professional politicians, they've never met a payroll. And, you know, there's something to that, and we all wish that the post office was as efficient as FedEx, and we wish that going to the DMV was as pleasant as going to the Apple store. But the truth is that business people, and CEOs in particular, operate in an environment where they can really have a lot of control and a lot of hegemony. They have boards of directors who support them. They have subordinates who will jump when they say. And it's not the same as trying to persuade people who have vested interests in working against you, especially if they're in the opposite party. Mitt Romney's father, when he was governor of Michigan, said that being governor of a state like that, where he had a divided government, was like being a quarterback of a team controlled by your opponents.
Still, that's some trio of adjectives to describe legislators: needy, wily, and fickle. They're pretty different. How do they even fit together? What image did you have in mind there?
Well, I guess I think back in some ways to my days 25 years ago covering the city council in New York. And, politicians, in fact, are very needy, that they want their ego stroked. They want the support of their constituents. They want love, as we see in the case of Bill Clinton. They're fickle in the sense that, Senator John Breaux of Louisiana once famously said, my vote can't be bought, but it can occasionally be rented. And what's the other one? Wily. Well, of course, they didn't get where they are by being naive, so most politicians are pretty crafty, and they know how to make a deal.
You also cite a study of the traits of the most effective politicians versus the most effective business people, and they are not the same lists.
No, that was really fascinating to me. There's been quite a bit of scholarship about what makes a successful CEO. And we think of charismatic CEOs like Jack Welch at GE or people like that. But the typically successful CEO is really a rather dull person who's determined, has ability to work long hours, is very focused and disciplined, finds the thing he's best at and is able to replicate it and do it over and over and over again. Whereas politicians need other skills. They need communication skills. They need charisma. They need the ability to rally people to their cause. It turns out that successful CEOs are more, they have a kind of more almost scientific bent in a way. They're just one foot in front of the other.
My guest is Todd Purdom, national editor for Vanity Fair. His new article comparing the records of business people and non-business people who became president of the United States. Do you think we saw examples of this on Romney's overseas trip that he's limping back from now, which no one considers the shining centerpiece of his campaign, that he had sort of the wrong traits for international diplomacy?
Well, it's funny because, Mitt Romney has suffered for not telling us what he really thinks about things, and he went abroad and both in England and in Israel, he delivered himself of some fairly tart opinions, which at the minimum were not diplomatic. So I don't know. Diplomacy is a learned art in some ways. I mean, there are certain niceties you have to be taught to observe, and presumably he wouldn't make some of these same mistakes again. But it was interesting to me to see that he did make, unforced errors. And he got himself into trouble that he could so easily have avoided if he'd simply been a little bit. One thinks of him as very polite, so it's somewhat surprising that he came off as sort of not gracious in the presence of his hosts.
Well, the going analysis regarding Israel, that he was mostly pandering to Sheldon Adelson, the conservative American Jewish fundraiser who was along with him on the trip, or I shouldn't even say fundraiser, mega donor, who kept Newt Gingrich's campaign afloat single-handedly with millions of dollars of contributions, and he's now moved over into the Romney camp. But I wonder if I could get your take on that particular thing that's really sticking in the Palestinians' craw. I don't know how much resonance it has with anybody else, but when he appeared to denigrate Palestinian culture in praising Israel's economic growth, he said, quote, "And as you come here and you see the GDP per capita, for instance, in Israel, which is about $21,000, and you compare that with the GDP per capita just across the areas managed by the Palestinian Authority, which is more like $10,000 per capita, you notice a dramatic, stark difference in economic vitality. And that is also between other countries that are near or next to each other, Chile and Ecuador, Mexico and the United States." And then he continues a minute later, "There was a book written by a former Harvard professor named The Wealth and Poverty of Nations. And in this book, He says, if you could learn anything from the economic history of the world, it's this: culture makes all the difference. And then he repeats the line, culture makes all the difference. And then when he came back to the United States and he was pressed on this, were you insulting Palestinian culture? Were you saying they have an inferior culture? Here was his response on Fox News.
I'm not speaking about it, did not speak about the Palestinian culture or the decisions made in their economy. That's an interesting topic that perhaps could deserve scholarly analysis, but I actually didn't address that. Instead, I will point out that the choices a society makes have a profound impact on the economy and the vitality of that society.
So, Todd, help me straighten this out in my own mind. Did he address Palestinian culture or didn't he address Palestinian culture?
Well, I think in the comment he made just now, he seemed to dig himself in deeper by sort of repeating his fundamental assertion, because what his analysis leaves out is that the Palestinian quote-unquote culture has been occupied for decades by, you know, Israel, and with security measures and strictures that restrict the flow of goods and commerce and have an incredible effect on the ability of the Palestinian territories to have a vibrant economy, or indeed a vibrant society of any kind, because they're living under, you know, basically military occupation. So I think what was lacking in his analysis and even in his subsequent explanation is that factor. The United States is not occupying Mexico. We do not have a finger on the scale of their economy or a thumb on their economy in the way that Israel clearly does in the Palestinian territories, and I think that's what's missing.
Well, does Israel tell the Palestinians that they're not allowed to have businesses?
No, it doesn't tell them they're not allowed to have businesses, but certainly the reality of the situation in those areas is that the flow of commerce is impeded, or at least, you know, greatly restricted because of the realities of on the ground. And I think that's what people were upset that Mitt Romney did not address. And instead of, you know, sort of doing armchair ethnographic studies and as if there was something intrinsic in the Palestinian character or the Palestinian mindset that made them economically inefficient.
So after he insulted the British by being an impudent guest at the Olympics and insulted the Palestinians, his least controversial act was to indirectly ask, why can't the United States be more like Poland? Listen.
Rather than heeding the false promise of a government-dominated economy, Poland sought to stimulate innovation, attract investment, expand trade, and live within its means. Your success today is a reminder that the principles of free enterprise can propel an economy and transform a society.
So who do you think that was aimed at? Is he appealing to somebody who's paying attention to whether the United States is enough like Poland?
I think he's trying to make the argument that, you know, he's for robust free enterprise. But the notion that the United States has a, quote, government-dominated economy, I'm not quite sure what country Mitt Romney's been living in for his whole life if he thinks that's the case. The United States economy is driven, you know, by the enormous power of the private sector. Yes, there are areas, healthcare, others, in which, you know, government employment has a huge factor. But, I mean, I think he's just, you know, being a little bit demagogic, frankly.
And I don't know if you saw this, but he comes home today to the Associated Press fact check column running in the Washington Post, and I presume other newspapers around the country since it's AP. And here's the headline in the Washington Post. Fact check. Romney ignores strong government role in Poland's economy as he heaps praise. And it says, even 23 years after throwing off a communist command economy, the Polish government continues to have a strong presence in people's lives. It gives women $300 for each baby they have, doubling that sum for poor families. It fully funds state university educations, and it guarantees health care to all its 38 million citizens. And while Poland's economic growth has certainly been impressive in recent years, this is partly the result of economic redistribution in the form of subsidies that have been flowing in from the European Union since it joined the bloc in 2004. So maybe Poland isn't exactly the way he portrayed it, or maybe we should have a big national debate in this country over whether to model our state universities and our healthcare system after Poland.
Well, I think what this shows is, like so many other politicians, Governor Romney is not one to let his talking points, you know, let the facts get in the way of his talking points. And he's trying to sort of sketch a very broad, almost cartoonish picture of what he thinks is wrong with Barack Obama's approach to the economy, and in doing so, he probably pulls a few what Mark Twain used to call stretchers.
If he got it wrong on Poland, they all get tripped up on Poland. Ford in 1976 in the debate said it wasn't under communist rule. Bush, I guess it was 04, used it as the shining example of international enthusiasm about the Iraq war.
Coalition, exactly.
That went over like a thud. And now this, maybe we should call it Valencicare, their health care system.
The Gdansk Triangle.
Before we end, though, the press corps. I wonder what you think of this incident yesterday. I thought, you know, though Romney should answer questions, the press corps did not bring much dignity upon itself either.
By shouting that way.
Yeah. I'm going to play this clip. When Romney refused to answer questions, as he basically did all trip, this scene ensued with reporters shouting questions and Romney's press person hushing them with, let's call it, strong language.
Some of the mishaps on your trip.
Governor Romney, do you have a statement for the Palestinians?
What about your gaffes?
Governor Romney, do you feel that your gaffes have overshadowed your foreign trip?
Sight to the poor people. Show some respect.
Governor Romney, just a
Show
few questions.
Show some respect.
You haven't had another chance to ask him questions.
This is a holy sight for the Polish people. Show some respect.
Unbelievable.
Hey, J-Mark.
So Romney's press person telling them there to shove it at the end. Those were the last two words. The previous thing there we had to bleep. As you heard, you could probably figure out that was. But I have to say, Todd, that's not anyone's best moment there. Do you really want to be the journalist shouting, what about your gaffes?
No, I have to say, I like to hope. I've probably made a lot of mistakes in 30 years as a journalist, but I don't think I've ever shouted at anyone. And I just don't think it's ever really good manners to shout. You know, that sort of started in the Reagan era in a way when the president would often decline to take questions as he would leave the south entrance of the White House and the helicopters would be whirring. So Sam Donaldson was in the vanguard of that trend, I think. But I just think if you can you know, avoid bad manners, whatever you do, it's probably going to help you.
Todd Purdom, national editor for Vanity Fair. His article out today called The Hiring of the President compares those who did have business experience before entering the White House to those who didn't. Todd, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Talk to you later.